In science, once you've used an experiment to find out how something works, generally speaking, the next step is for a bunch of people to repeat that experiment and make sure they get the same results. That's how you know it wasn't just some fluke. For a few years now, there's been talk of a replicability crisis in the science of psychology, and a KU professor is part of the team at the forefront of resolving that crisis. For the well-being of patients everywhere, I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and Alex Williams is here with me now. He directs the psychology program at KU's Edwards campus. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here. You have been working with a colleague on this, and we'll hear from him shortly. But why don't you start by explaining the basics of what it is your team has found? The press release from KU says that your study, quote, questions much of the statistical evidence underpinning therapies designated as empirically supported treatments by Division 12 of the American Psychological Association. Can you translate that into plain language?
Sure. So there's over 600 different types of psychotherapy. And in the past 25, 30 years, psychologists have really taken an interest in, okay, for what types of therapy do we have really good solid scientific evidence that they're effective? This is kind of paralleled in medicine. There's been a similar movement for evidence-based medicine.
And this is just really like kind of weird for me because I feel like I assume that once something is being used as a treatment, that that question has already been answered.
Oh, unfortunately, that hasn't always been the case.
Okay, go on.
Yeah, but psychology's really tried, though, to right that ship. And so they've been using a lot of clinical trials, just like in medicine, to kind of test out, okay, does this therapy actually work? Does it help people with the mental health problems that they have?
Yes, that seems like a good question to ask.
Yes, yes, exactly. And so there's been the Society of Clinical Psychology in the APA has done a great service to the field and to consumers and everyone by putting together a list of the therapies that are evidence-based psychotherapies that like, yep, for these we have scientific evidence that they work. Well, as you noted, in the last 10 years, there started to be these concerns about replication in psychology. It's been in other fields as well, but psychologists, I think, have done a nice job of trying to get ahead of it and address those concerns.
So it's not that the issue is unique to psychology. It's that the level of sort of poking at that is maybe unique to psychology?
I think so. I sound like I'm patting psychologists on the back in a way, but I do think that they deserve a lot of credit for trying to take this issue on heads on. And many psychology researchers have been involved in trying to do that.
So can you explain just how it came to be that we don't have the level of replicability and evidence that maybe the layperson does assume already exists?
Yeah. So as you were alluding to, I found myself in the studio here nodding along when you're introducing this because the idea is it's a cornerstone of science that we don't base scientific credibility on, well, one person found this result and, you know, Alex Williams found this result. Well, just take Alex Williams' word for it.
Like the 10 people that Alex Williams tested this on, it worked for them, but we aren't going to like investigate whether there's some reason why it wouldn't work for 100.
Exactly. Right. So the concern, you know, everyone kind of knows that in psychology and they would nod along, oh, yes, it's important to replicate. People hadn't really tested replication in careful, controlled ways, at least not systematically in the past.
What period of the past are we talking about?
Oh, I might get into trouble with some of my colleagues, but I feel like in terms of systematically testing it, the way we carefully are doing replication studies now, it's really been the last 10 years. And again, that's not unique to psychology.
That's very alarming. So it's that our standards have changed, though, is what it sounds like.
Precisely. Yes. Our standards have changed. And so in the past, the replication studies, when they were done, were just not as done in this by the same standards we'd hold them to today.
Can you give an example?
Sure. So in kind of psychotherapy that, you know, our study was looking at the credibility of a lot of scientific research. It might have been in the past that there was a study done and maybe it had a very small number of people in it. Some of the studies we looked at may have had just 10 people or 10 people in each part of the study, so 20 people in total. And then we say, well, another team replicated that finding and maybe they had 25 or 30 people. Anytime you have numbers of people that small in a study, you can get all kinds of screwy results that, as you alluded to, wouldn't necessarily then generalize to the population as a whole. They're less reliable than if we had, say, 1,000 people in a study like that.
So one of the conclusions of the study is that the field of clinical psychology may be ripe for a broad-scale reassessment of therapies that were thought to be supported by rigorous scientific evidence until now. And that sounds terrifying because I just think about people who have been putting faith in treatments for conditions that are causing problems in their lives. They're trying to heal and get better, and if those treatments haven't been supported by that kind of rigorous study, what does that mean for people who may be listening out there?
Well, I think it's kind of when we conclude our study, a colleague of ours asked, so what have you got for us? Good news or bad news? And our reply was, well, maybe it's both. Maybe it's both at the same time, that we had about 20% of studies that came out from 20% of therapies that came out in our study looking consistently credible across our different metrics.
20% looking credible.
Mm-hmm. Consistently credible across the majority of metrics we looked at. About 50% did not look consistently credible. I think that there are two things that means. And one is that's not the same thing as saying that they don't work. It's just across the metrics we looked at, they didn't look as good in credibility as we might want. The second thing is that for consumers out there and for clinicians providing these services, it may mean in part they just need to be more thoughtful about and careful about frequently assessing how therapy is going. So we can't just – that's, again, something that every clinician out there would nod along to, like, of course I do that.
It's like question whether this is working for this patient.
Exactly. Exactly. And so many listeners may have had the experience of going to, say, a doctor's office, and as part of a physical or things like that, they fill out the patient health questionnaire 9, the PHQ-9. It's a quick measure of depressive symptoms. Now, that's not perfect. But even just using something like that in tracking therapy to see, well, if I'm being treated by a therapist for depression, how well is it going? Using something like that even once a month is a big improvement over not doing that at all.
Alex Williams of KU, hang on with me for just a minute. I want to hear now from John Sakaluk, assistant professor of psychology at the University of Victoria. He's Alex's collaborator. Hi, John.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Good. So this study you did to look at which of these treatments passed the replicability test, how did it work? How did you set it up?
Yeah, so I think it's important to clarify that what we're looking at is not exactly a direct test of the replicability of the therapies that we evaluated, but rather there are certain kind of statistical qualities or kind of fingerprints of the strength of evidence in a particular article. We call these kind of metrics of credibility. And we were interested in looking at these metrics, which we think are ultimately related to replicability. But as Alex mentioned, there's been a movement in psychological research over the last 10 years. And one of the outputs of that movement has been the creation of these metrics where we can say, okay, we can take a closer look kind of under the hood of published research articles and gauge the extent to which they really seem to be dialing into something convincing here. Alex has had a long time passion for learning about evidence-based treatment. And when we had the opportunity to submit an article where we applied some of these new metrics of evidential strength, we thought that the empirically supported therapies literature was a really compelling case for, okay, we should take a look at this and make sure that we know what's what in this literature.
So there were four categories of basically like missteps that you're kind of testing for. And the first was just typos.
Yeah. The idea here is that, if I tell you that 2 + 2 = 5, you don't know whether one or both of the twos is a mistake or the five is a mistake, but you can tell me that those numbers don't add up. Much in the same way, when researchers report common types of statistical tests, they have to report certain values. And in a certain way, those values have to add up. So one of the simplest things that we looked at was, okay, if we extract those test statistics and we recalculate all the things that they imply, do the numbers add up or not? And in some cases we find, and for certain therapies, many times they don't.
Yeah. Okay. The next is statistical power or lack thereof. What does that mean?
Yeah, so I'll use an analogy here. Imagine that you have a friend who their lifetime dream is to go to Vegas and just win on the penny slots. They don't need to win big. They just want to win once, and they want to hear the magical ding, ding, ding sound. Now, if that friend told you, to live out my dream, I'm going to go to Vegas with 10 pennies and hope that I win, you would say, I don't know about your chances. I would feel a lot better, actually, if you went with 10,000 pennies. Then maybe you'll have a chance of winning. Much in the same way, scientists need to come prepared with an adequate amount of data if they're going to have a good chance of detecting the effects that they're interested in. In this case, you do a randomized clinical trial, and you're hoping, you know, if your therapy works, that you're in a good position to detect that effect of interest. And in a lot of cases, you know, as Alex kind of hearkened to, you know, we were seeing clinical trials with pretty small sample sizes. And in those cases, those studies and the therapies that they're evaluating wouldn't have awesome chances of being able to detect the underlying effects that we think would be reasonable for psychological interventions.
Okay, so typos and statistical power seem fairly straightforward, but then this next thing has a crazy sounding title and it scares me a bit. The R index.
Yeah, so if you stay with me with the penny slot analogy, R index kind of piggybacks on statistical power. And so if that friend went to Vegas and with their 10 pennies and won 9 times, you would say, wait a second. I know what the chances of winning on the penny slots are, and that you won 9 times out of 10. Something about that doesn't seem right, right? If you won a few times on 10,000, maybe you would say that would be reasonable. Much in this way, R index looks at how successful researchers should be in the long run at detecting their effects of interest, and then actually looks at, okay, but then how successful were they actually? And if you see this kind of inflated rate of detecting significant effects in the way of, you know, winning on the penny slots, that's in excess of what they should be prepared to detect given their sample size, then, you know, it's hard to say what exactly is going on. But again, it seems a little bit too good to be true.
So it's just like, because what if something is just amazing?
If something is that amazing, the interesting thing is that statistical power should match your long-run success of detecting actual effects. So those numbers, you know, in the number of effects that we evaluated shouldn't ever be different.
So you should have lots of statistical power to back up a really amazing outcome.
Yes, indeed.
Okay. How do you evaluate whether something passes muster according to the R index? Like, how do you decide how good is just about good enough to be true and how good is too good to be true?
Yeah, so this is kind of one of the complicating pieces of doing this kind of work, since a lot of these metrics are fairly novel. Power has been around for a long time, but misreporting, R index, and the fourth type of metric that we looked at are relatively recent in their large-scale application in psychological research. And so in some cases, there might not necessarily be a lot of consensus or public discussion about what would constitute good enough. And so one of the things that we did is we consulted with a number of methodological experts and said, hey, here's how we're thinking of saying this is how much, you know, this is how many statistical typos we think would be problematic. Does that seem like a reasonable characterization to you? Or, you know, how would you suggest that we adjust these kinds of cutoffs? And so we were really lucky to have a group of, you know, methodological experts who are willing to consult with us and have a little bit of back and forth dialogue and provide some very helpful suggestions.
And so then finally, there's something called the Bayes factor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Bayes factors, what some people in the public might not be aware of is scientists have kind of multiple schools to choose among when doing their statistical tests. And there's this whole other school of statistical inference called Bayesian that's a lot more popular in other areas of research. Psychologists tend to love this type of statistical approach where we look at these things called p-values, which sometimes leads us running into trouble when we break the rules of how to use them judiciously. And what Bayes factors do is you can kind of think of them as a weighting scale, you know, taking your data and saying, okay, to what extent do the data better support my hypothesis that these treatments are helping people versus them doing nothing at all. And the Bayes factor kind of gives you this ability to kind of appraise to what extent the data are more likely under either of those hypotheses. And one of the things that's neat about them is we can calculate them both for individual effects and individual studies, kind of saying, you know, at a very fine-grained resolution, here's what the Bayes factor has to say about this particular effect. But we can also use them to assess the credibility of groups of studies and groups of effects. So we did this calculating Bayes factors for entire psychotherapies or psychotherapies designated with a particular label, like having strong evidence and looking at, okay, how do these studies look according to the Bayes factor?
Tell me about a treatment or group of treatments that as you are looking into it, you had this just huge feeling of surprise or like, wow, this really needs some attention.
Yeah, there were a number of studies that I think, you know, on particular metrics were a little bit eyebrow raising. You know, for example, some therapies were quite high in terms of their misreporting rates. But I would say that I think, and you can ask Alex, but I think both of us were just more struck by the number of therapies that had been consistently described as possessing strong evidence that seem to perform poorly across multiple of our metrics. And so we don't think any one of these metrics is kind of the ultimate truth teller of to what extent these therapies are likely to be effective. But it does for us kind of raise a red flag that when people think about what strong scientific evidence means, they probably have in mind that the studies would look good in a way that is similar to the ways that we reanalyze these data.
Well, we will talk more about this in just a moment. We're talking about a study out of KU as well as the University of Victoria showing that the field of psychology is ripe for a sweeping reassessment of therapies thought to be supported by rigorous scientific evidence until now. If you have questions about this, you can call and talk to the researchers looking into it at 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman, Central Standard. We'll be right back. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. My guests are Alex Williams of KU and John Sakaluk of the University of Victoria. The two of them led a study suggesting, and I quote, "the field of psychology is ripe for a broad-scale reassessment of therapies thought to be supported by rigorous scientific evidence until now," end quote. Their findings have to do with replicability of studies long considered evidence for various treatments and their effectiveness. Call 816-235-2888 if you have a question about what this means and maybe what it doesn't mean, which is actually where I'd like our guests to pick up the discussion. Alex, when lay people like me hear this news, are there some conclusions we tend to jump to that maybe aren't quite right? I feel like I know just enough to be dangerous here, and I feel very alarmed, and I think that might color my interpretation of what you're saying to me.
Sure. So I think that's a fairly common conclusion just in talking with folks that people say. It's like, wait, oh my gosh, are you saying that, you know, therapy doesn't work, or should I be really alarmed by this? And, you know, no. I mean, that in the long run for the field, this is going to be – these are important issues to address. People are taking steps to make studies better. I think in the interim, if we're getting mental health help from a clinician, this is just something to be mindful of, and that hopefully clinicians out there are being mindful of as well. And it just means that, for instance, if we're trying one form of therapy and we're not finding that it's working after, say, 2 or 3 months, it may be time at that point to consider maybe we need to try something else. Maybe we need to try a different form of therapy. Maybe if we haven't tried medication before, we should try medication. It just means being more open to trying different things. So I don't think it's great cause for alarm in terms of this. The study does not mean that therapy doesn't work.
It does seem to me that when people seek help for psychological conditions or experiences, that part of what does work about it is the belief that there is help, you know, the belief that this is going to work seems to play into that. Am I wrong there?
That's an interesting question. That actually gets into that's a sort of a divisive issue in the field of how much expectations like that align with the benefits of therapy and if that's an important part of therapy. It likely is. And I would say that I have, you know, I personally would have confidence that if someone finds a clinician they like, that they believe is trustworthy, that can have a conversation with them about, hey, how are we going to make sure this therapy is working? They can have confidence that there's a good chance that therapy will work.
So how has the psychology community responded to your study? Has it been received with open arms, or is there some resistance, particularly maybe like some practitioner just has found great results with a treatment and isn't interested in revisiting that?
I think that two kind of prongs to that. I think that in terms of the general response in the field, I think there have been some good questions raised about if our study was at times too harsh and or too generous to different types of therapies. Sometimes people say, well, when you're getting pushback from both ends, you're doing something right. I tend to think, no. I mean, in fact, there may be legitimate criticisms. No one study is perfect. And so I think people should, in part, wait and see if our results are replicated. I think that practitioners in general, the issue you alluded to about what do they make of this if they see a therapy working with their own eyes, that's just an issue for clinicians in general. It's very hard when we see someone that we think is getting better from our form of therapy, it's very hard to consider other reasons they may be getting better that have nothing to do with the therapy we're doing.
So, John, what are the next steps from a research standpoint, from a like get back in the lab and take a look at some of these things standpoint?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that we've learned from the broader kind of discussion of the replicability crisis is maybe this kind of standard approach to research where it's one lab running, you know, one or two studies kind of on their own, maybe that needs to change. You know, clinical trials are really difficult to conduct. They require a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of person power. And the replicability crisis has done a good job of bringing people with shared interests together. You know, there have been several large-scale kind of collaborative attempts to evaluate the kind of replicability of the psychological literature, where dozens of labs have contributed their resources and time to kind of make it happen. And that might prove to be a really kind of inspiring and effective model of science for research on therapy to consider, where, okay, maybe if you have 10 labs who are all interested in understanding the effectiveness of the same therapy, we could probably do a lot better by pooling those resources and everyone running the same protocol, collecting a much larger sample, and ultimately potentially providing some more compelling evidence. I think the other thing is that, we should consider incorporating other methodological tools into the ways that we do our science. So there's things that we can do to make our research more transparent, to kind of restrict our ability to capitalize on analytic flexibility. So one of the things that we noted in our article is, you know, folks in this area are oftentimes using very similar research designs, and yet, there's a tremendous diversity in terms of the ways that researchers are analyzing their data, what effects they say are the really important effects. And we need, I think, to kind of dial it back a little bit and restrict ourselves and say, okay, here are the kind of standard designs. Here are what we think are the key effects that are going to come from those standard designs, and hold ourselves to kind of adhering to those guidelines and sharing information when we can.
I want to jump in and say I can just really imagine that the approach to psychological experimentation has changed a lot over time. So you also wouldn't necessarily want to replicate every past study down to the very last detail. That might just be my imagination running wild. And I admit I'm partly informed by the movie Ghostbusters, where the scientists are like, what do you see here? And she's like, a couple of wavy lines. And he's like, exactly. So brilliant. But I mean, the basis of the question really is, like, when you're looking at past research and the standards have changed, I'm assuming the standards have changed for more than just replicability. Standards have changed across the board.
And I think, you know, certainly in my kind of home discipline of social psychology, there are some older studies that, frankly, probably just wouldn't be ethical to try to directly replicate in present day. I don't know to what extent that would be a concern for folks wanting to replicate kind of older clinical psychology intervention studies. But definitely, I think you have to kind of take the current kind of methodological and ethical climate of you know, today's world into account when deciding how and what you're going to try to replicate in the scientific literature.
You know, Alex, John mentioned a little while ago that you have this longstanding passion for looking into evidence for treatments in psychology. I wonder if you can explain where that passion comes from and how it led you to what you're doing now.
I think I had a reputation in when I was in graduate school for being a bit of a gadfly. I would really poke around and say, okay, do we, you know, clinical psychologists, we're trying to do this good for people. The research on clinical psychology, ultimately the idea is that we're trying to improve the human condition. We're trying to alleviate people's mental health problems. And it's wonderful to have good intentions. Do we have evidence that we're actually able to do that?
I hate to play like psychologist to the psychologist, but what do you think it is that drove you to ask those questions, to be so interested in that?
I think that when I was actually first getting into graduate school in psychology, I read a blog on different forms of evidence-based psychotherapy. And it was called Psychotherapy Brown Bag, and it was run by a gentleman named Mike Anestis, who's now a professor at Southern Miss. And it just kind of opened my eyes to the idea of, oh, how do we know that a therapy is effective? It's not just a matter of opinion or conjecture. This is something that we can actually investigate. This is a scientifically answerable question. And I think just understanding that science could work like that, and that we have ways of answering questions like that and methods for doing it, that was just eye-opening to me. I just didn't appreciate the scientific method before then.
You know, it sounds like a person could hear the study you've just done as having poked so many holes in the field of psychology, but it sounds like from your standpoint, this is also like a source of hope that psychology can live up to this rigorous scientific expectation.
Precisely. And one of the things that we talk about in the paper, we think in some of these cases, what may be called for are psychological reversals. That's a term we're coining that's based off a phrase, medical reversal, that Vinay Prasad and Adam Sifu, two physicians, came up with for medical research. A medical reversal referred to the idea, okay, if I have a new treatment that I'm offering patients and it's rolled out and it's widely implemented and then it's studied, and it turns out, well, actually, it's not any more effective than the old treatments, or it's a lot more expensive without any additional benefit. We have to roll it back. We have a reversal of it. Same thing with psychotherapy. We may need psychological reversals. If some of these therapies aren't as effective as we hope, we may need to replace them with less costly alternatives. That's good for the consumer.
Alex Williams of KU's Edwards campus. This is fascinating work coming out of KU. Keep us posted, okay?
Thank you so much.
And John Sekulak with us from the University of Victoria. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Up next, a Kansas City poet paints a picture of life in America for a girl in a headscarf. That's a conversation from the archives that we thought would be timely to hear today. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now we're going to listen to a conversation with Aisha Sharif. We spoke with Aisha earlier this year, right after she'd published a book of poetry. The collection is called To Keep From Undressing, and it's as timely as ever. Aisha Sharif, good morning.
Good morning.
Congratulations on this book.
Thank you very much.
I did not say anything about you or your book just now because I feel like the best introduction is the one you wrote. The first page of poetry people would read if they had this book in their hands right now. Can you just give that a cold read, no preamble other than the title?
Sure. Why I can dance down a soul train line in public and still be Muslim. My Islam be black, not that don't like white folk kind of black. I mean my Islam be who I am, Black, born and raised Muslim in Memphis, Tennessee, by parents who converted Black. It be my two brothers and two sisters, Muslim too, Black, praying at Masjid al-Mukminun, formerly Temple No. 55, located at 4412 South 3rd Street, in between the strip club and the Save-A-Lot, Black. My Islam be bean pie Black, sisters cooking fish dinners after Friday prayer Black, brothers selling them newspapers on the front steps Black, everybody struggling to pay the mortgage back Black. My Islam be Sister Claire Muhammad School Black, starting each day with a pledge of allegiance, then prayer and Black history Black. It be blue jumpers over blue pants, girls pulling bangs out of their hijabs to look cute Black. My Islam be Black and Somali boys and girls, grades 2 through 8, learning Arabic in the same classroom, because we only had one classroom, Black. It be everybody wearing a coat inside, because the building ain't got no heat, Black.
This poem goes on for, like, about another page and a half. We'll get to that part. But you write it. So you write about being the only Muslim girl at school, getting asked what church you go to, being on the bus, hoping you don't get followed home. You write about two-stepping in a hijab. This collection of images paints a very complex and very real picture.
Yes, it very much does. This is a poem, and in many ways, the book is about intersectionality, right? What it's like to be an African-American Muslim woman growing up in the South, the Bible Belt, and how all of those identities converge seamlessly, but also with a lot of challenges, too.
Can we go through this and talk about some of the specific details in the poem and why they're important enough to you that they're sort of this is kind of like a here I am, this is me poem. And so I feel like these details are important in some way to, like, your sense of your own identity and how it's perceived. A temple between a strip club and a Save-A-Lot.
Yes. Well, to contextualize the temple, the Nation of Islam had a flourishing in the 60s and 70s within America, and they called their places of worship temples. And in the mid-70s, a lot of those people converted out of Nation of Islam into what we would kind of categorize as mainstream Islam or Sunni Islam. And so those temples were transferred into mosques or masjids. And so in Memphis, the masjid that I attended literally was in between a block that had a strip club on one side and then a grocery store, which was a Save-A-Lot on the other side. So it was just a very interesting dynamic to see the location of where we were.
And what's holy.
Yes, and what's holy, right? In this very Black community, we were worshiping as Muslims.
Blue jumpers over blue pants.
That's definitely the uniform. It was just very straight, monolithic colors, no razzmatazz, just very much about being covered. The girls wore pants underneath the jumpers in case we needed to do calisthenics. So that, you know,
in case calisthenics happen.
Right, right. Which was every day.
Celebrating Easter with your family as part of what it means to you to be a Black Muslim.
Yes, my extended family on my mother's side all were in St. Louis, and that's a very Catholic city. And so we would still integrate for Christmas and Easter because, again, as the poem says, family is still family. And so we didn't sever those ties.
And so that comes up actually as what I hear in my own mind as I read this poem as a sort of defense against someone who accuses you of possibly hating Christians.
Yes, the common misperception is that Muslims hate Christians and that we can't interact with Christians, even though we're living in a predominantly Christian society, which I think is so strange. Like, how are you not going to interact with Christians, this kind of big bad boogeyman that's going to take you away from Islam? But I think the great thing about being an African-American Muslim is that you can't just cut off your family, or you shouldn't, especially a lot of African-American Muslims convert. And so they have family that is Christian. It's a great interfaith conversation.
And then this note, which we didn't get to, about refusing to pray in a separate room. Can you read the end of the poem now so we can hear that?
Yes. My Islam be just as good as any Arab's. It be me saying, no, I ain't gonna pray in a separate room because I'm a woman, Black. And don't think that I can't recite Quran too. Now pray on that, Black. My Islam be universal because black be universal. It be Morocco and Senegal, India and Egypt. My Islam don't need to be Salafi or Sufi. It don't have to be blacker than yours black. My Islam just has to be.
Aisha Sharif, what is that last line about?
It's about just accepting the way in which people, particularly me and African Americans, approach Islam. There is a lot of, within the Muslim community, a lot of times African Americans are looked down upon because we may not be seen as the originators, quote unquote, because maybe we didn't inherit Islam from our great-great-grandfather. And it's just saying, hey, accept us. You know, we're here, we're Muslims, and we've been in America longer than you have. And some of the first Muslims who were in America were slaves, black.
Tell me about your family, starting with your parents, their separate backgrounds and how they ended up becoming Muslim.
Well, my father was born and raised in Memphis, Tennessee, and he was raised as an Episcopal. And my mother was born and raised in St. Louis as a Catholic. And they met, fell in love, got married. She moved to Memphis and in the mid-70s. And my father, I remember he's always said that he was always interested in other religions and, you know, had this book of world faiths, and he started really exploring other faiths, and Islam just really resonated with him, and he converted in the late 70s, and then when my two older sisters were already born, and then my mother converted right as I was born.
You have a poem where you kind of tell your parents' story separately, and the end of it is about what you think your mom might have given up.
Yes. Yes, I've always been curious about that because they lived very different lives before they converted to Islam, which was very much about, you know, parties and being seen in the social elite of events of the African-American community in Memphis. And so I wonder, you know, what is it like to convert, especially when the spouse converts first? You know, is that a conscious choice, or are you just naturally involved? And what are some of the things that my mom would have, you know, imagined for herself as a wife of this, you know, elite black man in Memphis? And now, you know, it was very much a shift, right?
Have you asked her that?
Yeah, she sometimes hasn't really thought too much about it. I think she expressed to me that she thought that she was going to live this traditional kind of Catholic life. And then they switched and she started wearing hijabs and going to the mosque. But she made it her own. There's another poem in the book where it's called Hot Combs and Hijabs, where I talk about how even though the shift was maybe not something she expected, she made it her own and had a wonderful blend between the life she had before and the life she adopted.
Yeah, I love your meditation on your mom's name changes. You talk about the significance of her different last names, and then both the last name change when she got married, then the last name change with the conversion. But then you write she kept Brenda for herself.
Yes, and I find that a lot of African American women, or even just women who convert to Islam, they keep their first name the same. It is a way to still hold on to who you were beforehand and to say, hey, I can balance this. I don't have to give up my entire life because I converted to a new faith.
Do you feel like there is a tension there, though? Like that there is maybe that expectation, whether it's imagined, that you imagine people expected of you just because it's what you see happening, or that is maybe also very real, that people really do expect those things?
Yeah, I think because there are people who do expect that, it becomes something that you start to feel like you need to take on yourself. And there are a lot of women who get so wrapped up into, oh, I need to have a new Arabic name and I need to dress, quote unquote, like an Arab, however that looks. And I just need to leave all of that behind. And I think that's unfortunate that expectation is even there.
I've pieced together some of your autobiography from the book of poems itself. And it seems like, yeah, you went to this mostly black Muslim school as a kid, and then that you switched to maybe a more diverse kind of high school setting?
Diverse in the sense that, well, I don't really know if it was diverse. It was predominantly African-American and Christian public school. So I became the minority.
Yeah. Can you talk about both of those school settings?
Well, being at the Islamic school, as I mentioned in that poem, was really amazing. There's a poem in the book called Kickball at Sister Claire Muhammad School, where this space was a space that made me feel like you could be Black and Muslim at the same time, because there weren't a lot of spaces that made you feel like you could be Black and Muslim. You were Muslim and Arab. And so that space really made those two identities fuse seamlessly. And then going into the public environment where, again, okay, I was Black, so I was comfortable in that area, but there was a lot of discrimination that I felt towards being Muslim.
How did you feel that?
Things that people actually said to me. There's a poem in there about an actual experience where a boy pulled off my hijab.
I want you to talk about this. This is so the name of your book is To Keep From Undressing. I'm guessing that references this very traumatic story.
Yeah, I mean, it references another poem specifically about a woman who's divorced, but I think it can be applied to this situation, and especially in light of hijab, which is something you adopt as far as the physical covering of the body. And so to have someone pull off your hijab is the act of them taking on the task of undressing you, right? That agency has been taken away from you. And it's, in many ways, it's like a rape in that sense, right? This is something that is holy for me, and you chose to enter my personal space and rob me of that.
Yeah. Can you tell this story for our listeners?
Yes. It was in seventh grade, and I was in gym class, and this was my first year at a non-Muslim school, and I had this crush on this white boy.
I think the detail that you liked him is really important.
Yes, because again, I had never experienced being around white boys before, because the Muslim school was, everyone was Black or Somali. And so white boys at the time in 1990, I don't know, you know, everything was like MTV and grunge and cool and laid back, and that's what he epitomized to me. Something that is off limits. And so when he approached me, I was tying my shoe, I believe, and he was so, you know, came up to me so casually. I was like, oh, wow, is he going to talk to me? And what he did was just pull off my scarf and ran and laughed. And I was so embarrassed, because that never happened to me. And I ran into the bathroom and cried. And somehow someone figured out that that was wrong, because I don't think they realized, oh, what that meant as far as the hijab is concerned. So we were both sent to the principal's office, and he was paddled in the days where you could still paddle someone in public school.
Yeah. And actually, like in your poem, you write about that, like, that it seems like that was in some ways also very traumatic for you, that, as you put it, you couldn't keep him from justice.
Yes. There's a part where they're a victim wants to sometimes save the oppressor from the crimes that they have committed, to this act of forgiveness, right? Like religion always, traditional religion also stresses the act of forgiveness. Oh, you're supposed to forgive. You're not supposed to want to see anyone in pain, even the oppressor. But since the door was closed, I couldn't stop it on a physical level, his paddling. And so it made me realize, hey, that person needs to experience the ramifications of their actions.
I'm curious, as sort of like a seventh grader, you were saying, what the hijab meant to you then, and whether wearing it today means the same thing to you now.
I think it definitely means much more now. I think that particular experience with the pulling off of the hijab, I think, made me wake up even more to it, because anytime you're used to doing something regarding your faith tradition, a ritual, especially a daily habit, it can become kind of ingrained to where you don't really think about it. And I think that particular moment as a seventh grader made me realize, oh, okay, this means something for me on an emotional level now. And I think as an adult, it definitely means a lot more now that I have children, and thinking about it in a post 9/11 context as well.
Can you explain that?
Well, the poem happened before 9/11, but now it's a marker that is much more global, and it's unfortunately tied to negative thoughts about terrorism and threats and whatnot. Even though for me, it's a beautiful expression of identity.
So on the cover of your book, Natasha Elskari writes in one of the blurbs that your poetry has the kind of honesty that gets you uninvited from family reunions.
Yes. And I have not been uninvited just yet. So we'll see what happens. But the book is very honest about certain relationships that I have and experiences with my family, particularly my father and my sister. Those poems kind of talk about what it's like to transition into a religion due to your parents and the effects of your parents' choices on you. And then also my sister's divorce and how, you know, divorce is a really big thing in Islam. It's like the one thing that you can do, but that is frowned upon, and how that affects Muslim women and how they're seen. So I'm very confessional and autobiographical in that sense, and it can be a little uncomfortable at times.
Okay, so speaking of that, I was really struck by a poem called Accent, and about what you call learning to switch tongues.
Yeah.
Sort of your journey of realizing that you pronounce words specific to the Muslim faith in a way that might be seen as particularly Black.
Yes, and I think that's one of the things that is interesting about being an African-American Muslim, kind of how we're viewed by other Arab Muslims who are native to Arabic.
So I want you to read sort of the last, I'd say, half of this poem, starting with "You Wonder."
Okay. "You wonder what other Arabic words you speak come out Black, how your assalamu alaikum sounds more like salam alaikum, how you pronounce the Arabic letter ayn like ain't, as in there ain't nothing I can't do as good as you. You always held your breath when your 11th grade English teacher, Mrs. Mulheron, called students to read out loud. Each time she made you stand and face the class when you said ax rather than ask. You learned to switch tongues around your cousins, that it was okay to say, I ain't tell nobody, but you'd always say bismillah under your breath as they said amen during grace at Sunday dinners. You wonder how many times you've translated yourself. Last New Year's Eve, you opened your home to your friends, spent hours making a playlist of 90s R&B songs, only to have your Palestinian friend turn off your music because it was haram. You wondered whether you were in your house or his. Even now, sitting in line for prayer, you avoid calling the adhan. You remember what your Saudi friend said. You can only know God in Arabic. You remember what your voice carries, your long drawl, your black-eyed peas and collard greens, your parents' Christianity. It reveals your Black neck, your familial disconnect, your fried chicken breath."
That last line. Is that one of those lines that can get you uninvited from parties?
Maybe not necessarily African-American parties, but maybe Muslim parties. Yeah, it definitely is an indictment against, I guess, the kind of discrimination within the Muslim community, particularly towards African-Americans, and this hyper-awareness that I think African-Americans have as Muslims about how they're going to be perceived once they start speaking Arabic and showing Islamic knowledge in light of being Black.
Have you ever forged really meaningful relationships across that divide that you've experienced?
Yes, and I want to qualify. I don't want to say that, you know, it's not impossible to have relationships amongst Muslims over races. It's definitely possible. I have tons of really great friends, even at IU. My first experience is meeting Lebanese Muslims.
That's
and Turkish.
Indiana University?
Yes, excuse me, Indiana University. Turkish Muslims, too. So those are friendships I still have today. But so it is definitely possible.
It seems like it might take a certain amount of courage to write this, in a way that's this revealing kind of across the different groups and what you refer to as intersectionality, like
yes,
to say things beyond these closed communities kind of makes you vulnerable in a way.
It does. And I think to some degree the Muslim community can be kind of closed. And I think it's because we're so afraid of being discriminated against by others that sometimes we don't talk about issues within our own community and how to bridge the gap within our own communities.
The music is here, and we didn't even talk about two-stepping in a hijab.
Oh, we can dance. We can still dance.
Aisha Sharif, thank you so much for joining me here today.
Thank you for having me.
Aisha's book of poems is called To Keep From Undressing, and it came out in January. If you missed our conversation earlier in the show about replicability in psychiatric studies, all of that will be on our website later today, kcur.org/centralstandard. That's where we archive all our shows. It's also where you can sign up to have them sent to you like a podcast, kcur.org/centralstandard. That's a wrap. Tomorrow, playgrounds are changing with an eye toward accessibility. We'll talk about that shift in how we think about play tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Ann Kniggendorf, Aviva Okeson-Haberman, and intern Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't go away.